This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to NSPS Radio Hour for another edition today. I want to welcome my two guests with me today. I have Al Jamieson, President, and Brian Munday, Executive Director for Alberta Land Surveyors Association. Welcome, Al and Brian.
Thank you, Kurt.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
So glad to have you both on here. I'm always interested in talking with folks who are either in our profession or related to our profession, and I know one of the things that surveyors here in the U.S. are always talking about is comparisons or contrast, perhaps, with how we do things here and how people do things in other parts of the world in terms of just practice and you name it, licensing laws, how do we deal with legislatures, what's the regulatory environment, how do we deal with ethics issues, how does the title insurance industry interact with us, how we communicate back and forth. So there's just so many different things to talk about. And maybe one way to start, and I do want you both to introduce yourselves, but maybe one way to start after that is maybe even talk a little bit about whether or not there are, and if so, differences from province to province in Canada. I mean, obviously we have the U.S. and Canada, but we have 50 states here, and you have all your provinces there, so I assume there must be some differences. But to begin, Al, if you would just introduce yourself and let our audience know a little bit about you, then we'll allow Brian to do the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely, Kurt. First off, thank you very much for the opportunity to be on your radio show. And my name is Al Jamieson. I'm the president of our Alberta Land Surveyors Association for this particular year. I'm running out my gamut until April. We have our annual general meeting, and just put a plug in that, Kurt, you're coming up as a speaker to that AGM, so we look forward to that in Lake Louise, Alberta here.
I'm looking forward to joining you, too.
Yeah, absolutely, and I guess just a quick response to your question about our differences in Canada. Yes, definitely the different provinces have different regulatory and licensing requirements and quite a difference in, I guess, land title systems and whatnot. A lot of that has to do with our eastern provinces have a couple hundred years on us out west, so some of the things, problems they've inherited over their historical, timeline, we've probably been able to dodge out west here, so there are definitely some differences.
Brian, if you would share a little bit about you with the audience.
Sure, be glad to, Kurt. I am the executive director of the Alberta Land Surveyors Association, although I'm not a land surveyor myself, which I guess makes me a little bit unusual in this profession. But I have been involved with the Land Surveyors Association, or land surveying profession, since 1992, first with the Ontario Land Surveyors for a number of years in eastern Canada, and then with the national organization for about 2 years, which did give me an opportunity to see a lot of differences and similarities between what we have coast to coast. And then I have been here in Alberta for the last, going up on 17, 18 years now, and certainly enjoying it.
And were you... One thing you said that was kind of interesting, you were talking about the National Association, and obviously we're a National Society of Professional Surveyors here, and we have affiliations at least with all of our state groups, and I think I've talked to you all about our joint membership program in which we have a special dues arrangement with our state societies who offer to the National all of their licensed members. Other members can be part of the program if they wish, but to get into the program, then the 100% of the licensed members, and to date we have 47 of the states plus District of Columbia that have signed on to that. Does your national work similarly to that, or is it, how does it operate?
An interesting question, because for many, many years it worked on a very different basis. But in the last year or two, certainly those involved on the national scene have looked at what has been happening with NSPS and has gone to the all-in model, as we call it here. And I think most of those provinces or most of the provinces have joined up and have become part of that. And a couple that are not, but certainly a lot of the members in those provinces do want to belong to that. I think it's one of those things where a number of people over the years, you know, have looked at it, and I know Al, having traveled across the country over the last number of months, you know, has certainly seen that there's a lot of similarities across the country, and I'm sure it's the same. You know, when the state societies get together, some of the details may be different in terms of how we deal with a number of issues, but we're all dealing with very much the same sort of issues. And how do we deal with our legislatures? How do we deal with public relations sort of issues? And we all approach it a little bit differently. But at the end, really, we're dealing with a lot of the same issues. So with that, we wanted to come together and see if there was a way of dealing with that on a national basis. And sort of what we were finding, or what the national group was finding, that one of the best and most viable ways of doing that was an NSPS-type approach of going to an all-in model to ensure some stable and viable funding.
Yeah, that's I'm glad to hear that, our model is something that other people are looking at. We had a lot of consternation going forward with ours just because of the nature of who we are, and I am one of those execs who is a surveyor. But in the States, that makes me kind of unique. We only have a handful of surveyors in our state societies who are actually the executives, so we are the ones, the surveyor ones of us are unique here in the U.S., as opposed to perhaps where what the situation that you have. But yeah, we certainly found that the main reason we wanted to do the program we did was from an advocacy perspective and a unity of advocacy to the federal government, at least. I mean, obviously all of our states deal with their state legislature, but that was a big issue for us, because it's a whole lot different to go talk to somebody in Washington, D.C. and say, we have members who vote for you, rather than we have a couple of members in your state. So that was a big incentive for us when we moved forward. So I'm glad to see that things are working, are beginning to work well for you. I hope they continue to work well for you on that same same situation. And I assume that when you went the route similar to what we did, I mean, obviously everybody still has their state dues, and in your case, I guess province dues, but are yours tied? Are they all the same, or are they separate?
Each province has a different due structure. Some do it related back to the number of members they have. Some make it a percentage of something. So it's all a little bit different. Perhaps the reason why we went to this advocacy body in what here in Canada is called Professional Surveyors Canada is because the provincial associations are a very different type of beast than what I understand that you have in the United States. Here in Canada, each of the provincial associations are what we call self-governing regulatory bodies, meaning that our role is not to generate more membership or serve the membership. Our role is to protect the public interest, meaning that we've got a regulator's role, we've got a different duty to serve the public and protect the public when it comes to land spheres and boundaries, rather than to serve the membership. So we are always in a difficult position at our provincial level, because we have to maintain that regulatory stance, and we can't be seen as an advocacy body. So that's where the national body can come in. So I think we're getting to the same point in time, just getting at it from a little bit different perspective.
Right, and in your case, your association, your provincial association, is similar in a lot of ways to what we have as our individual state licensing boards.
Yeah, that would be correct.
Like your mission is very similar to what they do.
Yeah, that's my understanding too.
Yeah. So we, I don't know, we've kind of left Al out of the conversation here, so I don't know if you have anything you'd like to add with that, but with what we're talking about there. But it is, I think it's an interesting distinction, and one that I think it's important for our listeners to know about, because we all have ideas in our minds about what other folks are doing and not doing. But
no, absolutely, and that has been my role here this year. We attend all the other general meetings, annual general meetings of the other provincial associations. So definitely the PSC intent is to be able to kind of draw the national interests and represent, I guess, the Canadian land surveyor on the landscape as opposed to just provincial designations.
Right. As a matter of fact, we just signed a memorandum of understanding with PSC in the last few months, just to show support for each other, which is a great thing, I think. No question about that. I think perhaps just from conversation and talking with people around the country and our state groups, I think in some ways our state groups would like to be in the same position that your provincial groups are in, which is to be independently regulated by the profession, because all of our licensing boards are governmental. And so they have surveyors on them, but most of them are also engineers and architects and all the way down to space planners and you name it. So I think a lot of our folks would like to have a surveyor board that was specifically for that purpose. Difficult to do, though. Some of our states do have independent surveying boards, a handful of them do. But it's not an inexpensive proposition, as I'm sure you could attest.
Yeah, as a group that's going through the budget process right now, I think we, Al and I, can certainly both attest it is not inexpensive. One of the things that, or I guess a couple of the responsibilities that we have as the licensing body comes in the form of discipline. We have the ability to discipline our members, and unfortunately that does happen several times a year. And I think, as anyone can appreciate, any time you get lawyers and court reporters and all those sorts of things involved, it is not a cheap proposition. So certainly all those costs continue to go up and up. We are also fortunate to have what we call a practice review or a continuing competency review program. And go ahead, Kurt.
We're at our first break already, so
okay.
let's go take that break, and we'll come back and pick up where we left off.
Attention surveyors, are you aware that yellow stick you're using is saving lives all over the world? Yes, that pinfinder is clearing fields and villages of unexploded cluster bombs and other hidden explosives in over 25 countries. Johnstead, in cooperation with international mine action programs, provides free locators to where they are most urgently needed. To find out how you can help, visit the NSPS website at nsps.us.com, and thank you.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on americaswebradio.com.
Quick stakes are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden stakes, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about quick stakes, go to www.quickstake.com, or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
And here's something new from Schonstedt. Did you know that Schonstedt has upped the ante on trade-ins? Now you can trade in any instrument, theirs or a competitor's, in any condition, working or not, and receive more in trade than ever before. Plus, they'll pay the freight both ways. Contact your local dealer for details or go to Schonstedt.com. That's S-C-H-O-N-S-T-E-D-T.com.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back for our second segment today with Al Jamieson and Brian Mundy with the Alberta Lanceros Association. Before we went to break, Brian was talking to us about some of the responsibilities of the provincial groups with regard to discipline and practice issues and licensing and all those kind of things. And I'd like to continue that conversation and obviously like to hear from Al from his perspective as well as the president of the association, but certainly as a practitioner. So, Brian, maybe if you could just pick up where you were, and then we'll let Al in on the conversation.
Absolutely. So one of the programs we have is what we call a continuing competency review program. And other provinces here in Canada would have similar programs, call them different names to one extent or another. In Alberta, our program involves reviewing each practitioner, each land surveyor, at least once over a four-year period. And so that involves filling out a questionnaire online, asking you a little bit about the type of practice you have, the sort of things you do. And then we go and review, or we have a staff that reviews at least one product, one survey plat that a land surveyor has prepared, and reviews that against the standard we have, and then provide some comments and feedbacks, Sometimes it's just merely a matter of saying, thank you, keep up the great work, and sometimes it involves, hey, you need a little bit more hate to say remedial work, but a little bit of extra help, a little bit of extra education, perhaps to get you back on the straight and narrow, so to speak.
And maybe a question for Al would be, in the States, most of the states, if not all, have mandatory requirements for continuing education, which means you have to go to a certain number of hours for credit in continuing education. A lot of people believe that it's maybe not as efficient as it could be or even as meaningful as it could be because it's not particularly prescribed as to what it would be. So I'm thinking maybe our folks would prefer the method you have. But I guess the next question is, do you have anything like that where you have to do mandatory classes, or is this review just simply as you discussed earlier? So maybe, Al, you can talk about that.
Yeah, certainly. No, we don't, actually, Alberta. We don't have compulsory mandatory education, and as I go across the different provinces, several of them do. And in fact, Kurt, I was attended with yourself in Montana, and I'd seen that they certainly did have compulsory, and that probably had a large, you know, was a large component of the attendance, I guess, they had at their seminars and whatnot. We've been quite fortunate in Alberta that we've had excellent, you know, attendance at our AGM. Our different committees seem to have no problem as far as drawing volunteers, and so people are very committed. But we also have quite an advantage because of the numbers and the economy in the western part of Canada here as well. But so I'm also a Canada Land Surveyor, and our ACLS does have compulsory, professional development. And so, as well, I've seen both sides of it, and I guess I don't know that one would really drive an individual any more so than another. It seems like it's the onus, ideally, I guess, would be on the professional, right? And our practice review, I guess, for lack of a better word, maybe ferrets out problem practitioners that we might have. And I guess really that's probably the onus of any professional review or professional practice would be that you, for lack of a better term, you have a couple of bad eggs and you want to make sure that you can deal with them.
Now, you said, if I understood you correctly, you said something about being a Canada Land Surveyor. So the way I'm understanding this is that licensure in the provinces is independent of other provinces, similar to what our states are. But is there an overarching license for the country for a particular activity?
Yes, there is, and it's a CLS designation, but in fact, there's a CLS requirement for any Canada lands, and Canada lands as per Crown lands in Canada would be any Indian reserves, any of the national parks, and in the Yukon and Northwest Territories is considered Canada, and the offshore. So it's
more like lands, what we would refer to as public lands here in the U.S. that are government owned.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. And of course, we have our Bureau of Land Management here that deals with a lot of those issues internally, although private practice does get involved in it to some degree. But I understand what you're talking about. As a matter of fact, it's probably not unique, but one situation that I know is kind of like that is Texas. They have a Texas surveyor that has met certain qualifications to do work on state lands. So that it sounds similar to that.
Yeah, so
perhaps just sorry. Go ahead, Al.
So, in fact, Kurt, if you do some work, for instance, on a national park in Alberta, there are requirements. A lot of times, you'll have to have both a provincial designation and your Canada Land Surveyor's designation to be able to perform surveys on those lands.
Brian, you were going to add something.
Thanks, Kurt. But if you happen to have the Canada Land Surveyor designation, that does not mean that you can work in any province. You still have to have the provincial designation.
Yeah, that's only for land, or crown land, or what we call public land, I guess.
Yeah, and I guess I would probably distinguish between there's federal crown land and then there's also provincial crown land. So if you're operating in provincial crown land, then you have to have the provincial license. If you're working on federal crown land, then you have to have the Canada Land Surveyor's license.
And are those licenses issued by the federal government?
No, in fact, they're issued by the Association of Canada Land Surveyors. So in the first segment, we were talking about the provincial associations, and I know my counterpart with the Association of Canada Land Surveyors probably was having a small fit, because it's not just the provincial associations, it's the provincial associations and the Association of Canada Land Surveyors. And I guess in that regard, the land surveying profession is unique in that the engineering profession or the architect profession doesn't have that same sort of structure. So I think the land surveying profession is unique in having this Canada lands federal licensure requirement.
And that group, which issues those licenses, is different from PSC, Professional Surveyor of Canada?
That is correct, yes.
Okay, all right. I want to make sure I understood that correctly. So I'm kind of getting a picture of this, and as we go further into the conversation, I want to talk about some of the other issues. I know you guys deal with ethics differently than we do here in terms of how they are... judged, if that's the right word. But before we get to that, I'm also interested in what role or what level of role the societies play in trying to influence legislation that affects the profession or anything related to the profession, for that matter. And is that done on the provincial and the federal level separately, I guess?
Well, I guess to take the first crack at it, yes, we try to do that. How successful any one of us is at it, I guess, is a bit of a question. Us being a provincial association, our focus is at the provincial legislature. In Alberta, particularly, we have what we call a Surveys Act, which specifies how, very broadly, how surveys are to be done. We have a Land Titles Act, which talks about our land tenure system, and we have a Land Surveyors Act, which talks about how our association is to be structured. So we spend a lot of time in front of our politicians and senior bureaucrats talking about issues on all those pieces of legislation. there's also from time to time stuff that comes up where municipal governments want to enact things or establish some bylaws in terms of how surveys are done or what they want to see shown or how they interpret certain things. We don't spend as much time on those, but certainly individual land surveyors spend a lot of time working with their municipal offices trying to get things the way they want them and educate them about the importance of land surveying.
Yeah, that again, that's pretty similar, actually, to what we do. You know, NSPS, we look at national legislation and how it affects or applies to people anywhere in the country, and then, like you said, we have the state groups, and then there are local groups. So I think there's a lot of similarity in that whole area. Of course, our primary interest is how it affects the profession overall and the people that we serve. So I think there's a lot of similarities in the way our legislative outreach works because of the tiers, I guess is the right terminology to use in terms of how we approach that.
Yeah. Now, one of the things, too, sorry, just to interrupt, Kurt, and Al, you've come to a number of the meetings with the ministers and the government people, but I think what we have to be careful when we go do these sorts of things, again, because of the type of organization we are, we can't be blatantly advocating or lobbying for the individual land surveyor. We have to make sure that we present it very much in a public interest argument. Would you say that's correct, Al?
No, absolutely. Yeah, that we don't want to be seen as self-serving at all, and sometimes that's a little bit difficult to do, but certainly when we want to be at least a stakeholder in those decisions that affect us. And it's been a struggle at the, probably saying at the least, Dame Brian, to be able to try to have a voice within our government.
Yeah. I don't know how you find it, Kurt, but certainly, there's a regular turnover in political staff and even administrative staff. So it seems sometimes like, hey, you finally get someone who understands what the profession is all about and what you're trying to do, and the next thing you know, they're gone, they're off to other things, and you're back starting at square one again.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And that's true at every level, whether it's somebody in a local jurisdiction or somebody at a regional or state jurisdiction or at the federal jurisdiction. You're very exactly right. It's very, very difficult because you have people who understand what your interests are. And you're also right about remaining objective and being careful because of representing the public interest as a professional and not being seen as self-serving in what you're trying to get across. And so I see that we are at our second break. So let's go do that, and we'll come back shortly.
Getting into underground utility location? If so, you'll want to know about the Schonstadt Instrument Company's MPC kit, a multi-purpose combo for locating both ferrous objects and underground pipes and cables. And because it consists of two instruments in one package, it qualifies for trade-in allowances on two locators. Any kind, any make, any condition. Contact your dealer for details or visit www.schonstadt.com. That's S-C-H-O-N-S-T-E-D-T.com.
Hello, I'm Ray Bowman, and I'm really looking forward to our new show, Food and Farm, brought to you every Friday at noon on America's Web Radio by FeedstuffsFoodLink.com.
Quick stakes are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden stakes, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about Quick Stakes, go to www.quickstake.com or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're at the time of our show where our sponsor, Parker Davis Quick Stakes, sponsors its question of the week, and I will ask our guest a question, the answer to which the first person who
emails to quickstakescontest@americaswebradio.com will be our winner for the day. So to make this easy for our audience, I will ask either of you to answer, what does the acronym ALSA stand for?
The Alberta Land Surveyors Association.
Alberta Land Surveyors Association. That's the answer we're looking for. Thanks for helping us with that today. I appreciate it. We've covered some of the regulatory side. We've talked a little bit about the legislative side, and we can continue to talk about that as much as you guys want to. One of the things I know that our audience will be interested in, though, is the whole ethics side of things, and really that's why I'm coming up to your conference to have a conversation with folks about that in a general sense, not in the specific sense that you deal with it. But it seems to me in conversations that we've had, you as an organization deal with those obviously more so than we do, and maybe more so than they get dealt with in any way in our states and localities, because it seems to me, and I think most of our members would agree with this, when ethics issues come up, it's difficult to have them adequately addressed even through our state licensing boards, which are basically a regulatory group. And then on our end, as the society nationally or the state societies, we don't really have any jurisdiction to do that. So I know our audience will be interested to hear how that works for you guys.
Do you want to start that one off, Al?
Sure. Yeah, we can. So we do have a discipline process. Essentially, if there is a complaint comes in from the public or another land surveyor, it's dealt with by our registrar, and they basically can mediate it decipher, do enough investigation to see if it's a legitimate complaint, and from that point it would go to our chairman of our discipline committee, and they would once again do an investigation, and if it escalates, you know, to a point where there is a discipline hearing, that discipline hearing would be a group of peers basically would, and Brian mentioned before that entails, you know, court reporters and lawyers and whatnot, that escalates the costs, of course. But at that time, then there would be a hearing that, the evidence was presented and a decision could be made whether or not, you know, it would essentially be deemed as either unskilled practice or unprofessional conduct of the individual. And at that point, there's a number of different avenues available to that discipline committee, certainly one of them, you know, being suspension of a commission or a mentorship required or a fine. And typically, if that is the case, there is an appeal process for that practitioner that can go to the Council of our Land Surveyors Association. So I think it is typically seen to be fair and above board. It certainly it is something that's very common that our members get disciplined, but it's a process that has seemed to work well over the years. And I don't know if you'd have anything to add to that, Brian.
Yeah, as you mentioned, Al, somebody can make a complaint for unskilled practice or unprofessional conduct. And certainly one of the things that I found sitting in this chair is that one of the most common reasons for a complaint is not how the land surveyor did the survey or what evidence they used, but for the most part, it really comes down to communication. Did that land surveyor communicate to his client that the cost of the subdivision was going to be, you know, 25% higher than what he originally quoted? Did that land surveyor tell the other land surveyor that found an error in his survey from, you know, 10 years ago? Really, most of these things absolutely come down to communication, and the more people can communicate, certainly the simpler it makes my life, and really makes the life of the land surveyor a lot easier. What we found is that we get a lot of I guess I won't say complaints, but we do get people complaining. Somebody came to my front yard and started digging up looking for a post. Somebody was doing something and they didn't explain what was happening. And again, these days, oftentimes what we're finding is that it's not even the land surveyor themselves who are in the field, but it's often senior technical staff who are doing that, and really goes to show the importance of educating and training your staff in terms of how you want your company, and I guess by extension the whole profession, represented when they're out there in the field.
Yeah, and it seems that a lot of times when those kind of things come up, they start with some sort of disagreement among landowners that maybe goes into court. And is that the way it works? If two landowners are at odds with each other, here, for example, they go high lawyers, and then the lawyers go to court, there's some effort being made now to see if there's a way to insert qualified surveyors into the mediation process to help solve those rather than take them to court. I don't know if that's ever going to get anywhere here, but it's certainly part of the discussion right now. But that's really where things kind of start. Somebody's unhappy about something that's occurred, and then, of course, surveyors can get brought in for the whole part of being unethical could come into that discussion. It's not the only way it comes in, but sometimes it does. I don't know if that happens on your side or not.
Yeah, sometimes what we have happen is I will get a phone call and somebody says, my neighbor's fence is encroaching 3, 4, or 5 inches onto my side of the property. We need to do something about this. And my first reaction, of course, is, well, how do you know that it's 3, 4, 5 inches, 10 feet, whatever it happens to be? And sometimes they make that claim without ever having spoken with land surveyor, and certainly at that point we try to tell them the importance of hiring a land surveyor. The other thing that we've had in place now, perhaps for the last 5, 6, 7 years, is something that we call a boundary panel, and that's a mechanism we have in place to deal with situations where one surveyor disagrees with the professional opinion of another land surveyor. So it's not very much a, hey, you obviously made a mistake, or a landowner disagrees with the land surveyor, but a situation where land surveyor A just has a different interpretation from land surveyor B about where that corner is or where that boundary is. And so we've got a non-legislative mechanism available and some funding available to try to get to a solution to that so that the landowners themselves are not left high and dry.
Is that operated through the association?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
And as far as I'm aware, no other Canadian association has a similar sort of mechanism in place. So we're still very much at the infancy of trying to figure out how to make it work most efficiently.
Yeah, actually, it sounds similar to this, what I was talking about earlier, where some folks are trying to figure out a way they refer to it as mediation panels, but it sounds very similar, actually. But the other side of what's being proposed here, and I'm actually going to have a whole radio show about that here soon, is finding a way to allow surveyors who are dealing with property owners. Obviously, you don't ever deal with one property owner when you're out there working, and an issue arises, that person would have some authority to help them look through all the facts and resolve the issue rather than having to hire lawyers and go to court. And I don't know if that's going to get any wheels or not, but it's a thought that's come up nonetheless.
Yeah, we have a similar sort of situation under the legislation in Alberta to get a lawyer, a land surveyor, and a third party together to listen to a matter regarding an alleged survey error, and they have the authority to undertake that and make a final decision. unfortunately, there's no, that's through the government, so there's no ongoing funding commitment for it. So consequently, it has not been used a whole lot. So this boundary panel that we were talking about earlier is really designed to help deal with it. The downside of it is it doesn't have the legislative authority to say, you know, the coroner is here and shall not be questioned.
I see. Yeah, that's very interesting. And speaking of where the coroner is, and we only have a couple minutes until the next break, but we can obviously carry this over to the second break, but I guess maybe we could talk a little bit about that land system itself. As you know, ours here is kind of hodgepodge. We don't have structure by and large. Obviously, we do have subdivision structure and all those kind of things, but certainly not the land system or land title system that you guys have. And, so maybe you could talk a little bit about that in terms of how it works provincially or if there's some uniform way it's handled everywhere.
Sure, I could probably jump in on that, Brian. Yeah, we're under the Torrens system of land, our land title system here, which is proven to be pretty solid, really, where it's a mirror, really the mirror concept, where whatever you see when we pull a title reflects what interests are in a piece of property. And I have seen our eastern Canada, because once again, because of the couple of hundred years advance, basically civilization that they've had, their deeds registry system certainly brings lots of problems with it. Lots of, meets and bounds, and really the level of, I guess, research that has to be done to research a title versus what we're able to do here. So we're very fortunate, I guess, in the fact that we're, you know, a little over 100 years old, but we were able to, I guess, benefit from I guess, the development of land titles in eastern Canada. So our system right now, as I say, with the Torrens system, we are able to pull the title, and really that one document, which is guaranteed extent of title from our provincial government, allows us to pretty well, you know, is all the research that's required from a land surveyor's perspective.
Right. Well, we're right at the next break, so we'll go here in just a couple of seconds. The question I was going to ask is, when we talk about that kind of system here in the U.S., the first thing somebody says, well, what do surveyors do after that? There's nothing for surveyors to do. So maybe we can talk about that when we come back. So let's take our last break, and we'll be right back.
Sure.
Well, from my perspective, this is going well.
Good. Glad to hear that.
Yeah, thanks, Kurt. Yeah, so I guess going forward, I did find that in our eastern Canada, like I say, there's a large amount of the land surveyor's job there is researching title and, you know, historical. And I guess, as you say, what do we do after that? I guess in Alberta, really, it's more of a evidence governs system here, so that the actual property boundary is governed by a post in the ground, regardless of measurement. So it's a little bit of a different, I guess, different concept than we see in a deeds registry system.
Yeah, let's talk about when we come back, because one of the big issues here is our whole pen farm situation, where you go to a corner location and you'll find five or six different irons within a foot of each other. And that all boils down to measurement over reality, I think. But that would be a good thing to talk about.
Quick stakes are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden stakes, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about quick stakes, go to www.quickstake.com, or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
Schonstedt Instrument Company has been making locating easier since 1953. First, with its yellow stick, the GA52CX, the industry standard for sensitivity. Then, the GA72CD, a shorter and more rugged version offering a magnetic polarity display and a battery and sensitivity indicator. And most recently, the GA92XT, built for portability. It retracts to fit in its holster and extends for one-handed operation and fingertip control. See them all at Schonstedt.com. That's Schonstedt.com.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
And we're back for our final segment today with Al Jamieson and Brian Mundy with Alberta Land Surveyors Association. And I understand from David that perhaps we were still on the air when we didn't think we were. So maybe part of our conversation people have heard, but for those who go get a drink of water or have a quick sandwich or whatever we do during the commercial breaks, we'll go ahead and follow up with that conversation. But what I had said before we went to break was with the Torrens system or something similar to Torrens system, oftentimes what you hear from the survey population is, oh, that's all well and good, but what do surveyors do after that occurs? What's left for the surveyor? And Al, you had started talking about that in terms of what is the surveyor's responsibility after that point. So maybe you can just reiterate that.
Sure, and Ed mentioned that basically we're in an evidence governs system, so that a post on the ground essentially dictates a property corner regardless of measurement or, I guess, any other plan configuration. So that said, it somewhat takes away the ambiguities, I guess, if someone, you know, a measurement from 1950, if it differs by an acceptable means, well, it really doesn't matter because the post is what governs our property boundaries. And, you know, when you question, I guess, what does a land surveyor do beyond that, I guess in Western Canada, land surveyor, a lot of us, being in oil and gas business, we, you know, provide lease, pipeline lease right-of-way documents and leases for right-of-ways that define, I guess, rights of leases for oil companies. So, you know, beyond just doing research of title, you know, we're not just dealing with public property, I guess, in that regard, with our oil clients being a major part of our business here.
Right. But even when you're doing the research on the land title, if I'm in understanding what you said correctly, there's still a measurement aspect. You are verifying location of property corners. It's just that you're accepting the ones that are there. Am I understanding that correctly?
That's correct, Kurt. And typically, I mean, your parameters are within reason of the time, whether it be, you know, that would have been done by chain or total station or today's method of GPS. So the measurement certainly has a component of it, but at the end of the day, when it comes down to centimeters, as you say, there certainly would be the post would be accepted as a corner as opposed to a measurement that would differ by, you know, maybe 4 or 5 inches.
Right. Yeah. And that's, as I said when we were in the break, is a dilemma that we have here that doesn't bode well for the surveying profession when we're talking about the folks who define or identify, should be a better term, I guess, where property boundaries lie, and then we can't seem to agree on that. So it causes, a bit of a dilemma for us as a profession that when people go out and we say, yeah, you can take your GPS unit out there and you get some value, coordinate value for your property, and you go out and find something, that doesn't mean that it's exactly where it's supposed to be. And then the retort to that is, well, what all these 4 or 5 around this area mean then? So I think it's harmful to us when we let measurements override where property boundaries are actually supposed to lie, and it seems as though the system you guys have takes care of that pretty well. And I don't know, Brian, if you have anything to add to that. I am interested in the title insurance side of it, though, is what role it plays in how you guys operate.
Okay. Well, perhaps just before we get to that, just to add to what Al was saying, it's always interesting. It usually happens on a Monday morning. I will get a phone call at the office, and particularly springtime and summer, you know, neighbors have been out in their backyard or their front yard, and they're doing some landscaping, and they will come along and they'll give me a call Monday morning and say, that surveyor made a mistake. And I go, what do you mean the surveyor made a mistake? Well, I went out with my tape measure and I measured, you know, X number of feet and 6 inches, and the surveyor said it was Y number of feet and 4 inches. So that darn surveyor obviously made a mistake. And so we try to spend a lot of time educating the people who call us and trying to explain that it's not about measurements, it's about where those posts are. And it can be a difficult concept for the, you know, general person on the street to understand that that frontage on their property is maybe not exactly what they thought it was. So I think we certainly have a very good system, but that is another thing that you know, we do spend a lot of time trying to explain that to the public.
Does that ever result in any kind of issues when you said that the distance along the property line? I know here we have a lot of regulation about lot sizes having to be a certain size, you know, maybe the minimum lot width for a particular subdivision is 100 feet or something. And it turned out that it was, you know, 99 and a half feet. Does that end up causing any trouble if somebody's trying to get a permit from the local jurisdiction, or is it just accepted that that's where it is?
As far as I'm aware, that's accepted in terms of where it is. What can happen is that, you know, certainly, you know, the older our province gets, you know, a number of those monuments do get destroyed over a period of time, and then the land surveyor is forced sometimes to go in there in proportion or mathematically, you know, figure out where those lot corners originally were. And it can happen where if you start at one end versus the other and sort of the methodology used to do that, so there certainly can be some differences there. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, we do have our boundary panel. So if it gets to be to that extent, you know, we do have ways of trying to get that fixed up for people. But I think certainly we have a good system here, but that doesn't mean we're not without our own fair share of headaches.
Yeah, I know a lot of the issues we run into are actually subdivisions occur, but no actual land measurement ever occurred. And, you know, this can go back 100 years or so, maybe, and then people come in and sort of work their own system, so to speak, and then it becomes quite an issue at some point in time. But that's what they pay us all the big money for, right? That's what we're supposed to figure out.
But Kurt, you're right as far as, I mean, if a lot's shown as a 25-foot lot, for instance, and I know right now if some of these old lots, they try to shoehorn a house into it, where every inch counts, and your minimum side yard requirements and whatnot, it can create some problems if that 25-foot lot becomes, you know, 24.8 feet.
Right.
You know, that's kind of where we run into some issues. And, of course, then they can't meet the regulatory requirements of the minimum side yards and squeeze their house in. So it does create some problems, yes.
Yeah, and I could see where even on a title issue, ultimately, those can become issues when perhaps houses already exist, and then you find out that it maybe doesn't add up to what it's supposed to do, but I certainly understand how those work. We've got 5 minutes or so left, and I don't know if I've missed anything that you guys want to cover, and I certainly don't want to overlook that in terms of your association and your outreach to your members and those kind of things. So if you want to chat about any of that, we can. If you don't have anything you want to share there, we could talk a little bit about how title insurance works with what surveyors are doing.
You had mentioned title insurance previous, and to date, I would say, I would suggest the majority or a large amount of our house transactions are still, in fact, using survey reports, what we call real property reports. The big issue, of course, with title insurance and is always the timing and somewhat the cost, but certainly the issues are always, it seems like a real estate transaction comes down. to always to the last day when they realize it's going to close and they want a real property report survey. And, of course, that's impossible to be able to generate that within a matter of a couple of days. So,
I think we talked in our original discussion about getting the call at 10 in the morning because I want to close at 2 that afternoon.
Yeah, and that's very, very difficult.
I've had those
calls before. Yeah, so us as a profession, you know, to, I guess, combat, for lack of a better term, title insurance infiltrating our, you know, our transactions, that's always been an issue, is the timing to get the survey done, and then also typically we would have the local municipality approve that to, you know, identify that it's in compliance with your local bylaws. So it is a bit of an uphill battle, but certainly at the end of the day, you know, the title insurance aspect can disguise some problems that are going to come up later on for a homeowner. So there is certainly value that we can sell.
Exactly. Well, Brian, maybe you could chat a little bit about, I know you have a really great magazine that you use for outreach to your members. I guess, like us, you're always struggling with what's the next thing down the line. We use the web, we use email, and we have a weekly email newsletter that we send out now, too. And I'm assuming that's a challenge for you as it is for us.
It always is. There's a number of, you know, for us particularly regulatory things where certain things need to be done by a certain date. Otherwise, they don't get to maintain their license. So coming up by January 31st, all of the surveyors corporations, because we also regulate the corporations, must submit a renewal form to us to make sure that it meets the ownership requirements that we have in place. For what we call our articling students, there's a deadline of January 15th for them. So there's a lot of, I guess, what I'll call noise out there, you know, however many emails all of us get in a day, and you know, magazines and stuff that comes in. So how can we, as a profession, make sure that the information that we send stands out so that these regulatory deadlines don't get overlooked? And then beyond that, how do we make sure that the information that we're putting in our magazine 4 times a year is interesting and relevant to our membership? And then how do I get people to write about those sorts of things? I mean, you know, surveyors are great surveyors, and I think Canada, the U.S., it doesn't matter. But getting these very knowledgeable, experienced people to sit down and you know, put their thoughts on paper and their experiences on paper, so we don't lose that that generational experience, is certainly something that I have been spending a lot of time on, and I know we've got an historical committee that you know, looks at how we try to capture all of that information. So it's an ongoing challenge, and you know, I think once we figure out the best way of doing it, it won't be the best way of doing it anymore. It'll be something else that we'll have to do.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, and we face those same challenges. And I think that's an international situation with surveyors in terms of our having the time or taking the time to sit down and share what we know with other people. And speaking of sharing things, we're 30 seconds away from leaving, so I don't want to miss the opportunity to thank you both for being with me today. It's been a great conversation. I know that our audience has enjoyed it, as have I, and I hope it's been worth your while to join me today, but I do want to thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Kurt, and anytime you like to have us back, I'd be more than glad to do that.
Sounds great. I'll look forward to seeing you guys in April.
Thank you, Kurt. Look forward to you enjoying our AGM. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
This is America's Webradio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for